Ethan, what's our favorite politician been up to this week?
Well, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been caught eating a burger at a restaurant.
Now, wait a minute. That's not quite the picture I saw this morning. I thought the picture I saw, she was sitting next to someone who was eating a burger.
No, I'm pretty sure she was eating the burger.
Either way, is this really newsworthy?
No. Why would I wish I was getting in the news for eating a burger.
Man, that must have been one really good burger. I mean, now, did you see the other thing that she came out with that made a few headlines?
Her comic book?
Well, there's that. I mean,
that's
what
my
politician
favorite.
Wouldn't want to have a comic book? That's not what I was thinking of, though.
What are you thinking of?
Well, she has officially come out, and I'm probably going to mangle the quote, but I'll try, stating that, parents should probably not have kids because climate change is bad, and that's about as eloquent as it is.
What is the evidence behind that? Is it just our body warmth is heating the earth to the point we're all going to die?
Well, I don't really know. It seems that it follows from her conviction that 12 years from now, everything's going to be pretty bad, and therefore, people shouldn't have kids. Which,
well,
I'm of the opinion, I like people, I affirm people,
right.
I'm in favor of there being more people. I think that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, so I hope that I'm able to make some life choices without AOC's policies in place to prevent me from doing pretty much everything in the future.
Well, I'm sure if nothing else, AOC will continue providing hilarious intros for our show.
And eating burgers.
That's it. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to What's the Res? An ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. My name is Josh Herring. I'm a debate coach at Thales Academy in Rollsville, North Carolina. I'm joined today by Ethan Delves. Ethan, what should our audience know about you today?
My audience should know that I love debate, and I am here to help with resolution analysis, and we love getting questions on answering all of your questions about debate, because debate is just one of probably the best thing in the entire world, because dialect is key, and bouncing ideas off of each other is one of the most important things, and greatest gifts of the human race.
Well, with that enthusiastic intro, we're here today to discuss the latest public forum resolution that will be debated at NSDA tournaments in the month of April. Ethan, read us the resolution.
Right. The resolution is the United Nations should grant India permanent membership on the Security Council.
There is a ton going on in this resolution.
Oh, yeah. We're going to need some context for that one.
We probably will. But before we go kind of for a grammatical breakdown and try to weave grammar and context together, Ethan, give us the bird's eye view. What immediately leaps out at you from this resolution?
I think permanent membership is something that really leaps out to me, because on a surface view, when I first see something like this, it implies that there's a difference between temporary membership and permanent membership, and there's like a balance of powers between those two is something that I foresee.
Oh, that's a good insight. We'll have to get into that, because that is the big issue of this debate, about whether or not India should be with all the other countries that have the opportunity to rotate in and out of the Security Council, or whether they should join the big five that are the permanent members with veto power.
Wow, this resolution has a lot of weight to it.
It's going to be quite fun. Well, let's get into it bit by bit. So let's start with our subject. Ethan, what do you know about the United Nations?
The United Nations is an international peacekeeping organization, and it was formed in the aftermath of World War II.
One thing that we might then add to that is that they have their primary burden coming out of that aftermath is to prevent global warfare from ever happening again.
Right, and I know they have this enormous doctrine on human rights. I think it's, how many is it? Is it like 30 or...
I haven't looked at it recently. There's something, I want to say 36, 38. It's the United Nations Charter on Human Rights, Statement on Human Rights. We'll put the link in the show notes. I don't have that one in front of me at the moment. But they certainly are all about affirming different human rights all around the globe, and particularly the stated mandate of the United Nations is to be a place where nations can come together and can solve their issues through diplomacy, through economic arrangement, through pretty much any other means than armed conflict.
Right.
So particularly coming out of World War II, we've got the new reality that all of a sudden military technology has progressed to a new level with the development of the atomic bomb, and now today nuclear weaponry that can destroy the world and the human race on an unforetold scale. So the United Nations' goal is to prevent any kind of global warfare from happening.
I feel like this United Nations Council is a very necessary thing to have, because I believe in countries, you know, staying separate and staying to their own devices, but I feel like all of these countries do need to come together under some sort of objective doctrine and some sort of objective recognition of things like human rights in order for the world to operate in a way where everyone's starting from somewhere. You know what I mean? Because if you're not starting on that same foundation, such as the human rights that the United Nations has laid out, then you're really going off of nothing. And that's, I think that's where warfare kind of stems from, or at least the beginnings of it in some cases.
Well, certainly that was that vision is at the heart and soul of the United Nations. That was beginning with President Woodrow Wilson in the aftermath of World War I and his 14 points and starting with the idea of the League of Nations, and then growing into the United Nations in the aftermath of World War II. That really is the goal. Can we have a place where we can have kind of almost the image of a big round table where all the nations could gather in a room and solve their problems together rather than marching their armies to places and killing each other to settle important questions?
We've spent a lot of time on the subject of the resolution.
We have. Let's move on to the verb.
Let's get it.
So for the verb, we've got grant. Any particular things we should note about this verb grant, Ethan?
Yeah, this verb also carries a lot of hidden weight when you first look at the resolution, because granting means, one, it's permitting on behalf of the United Nations Council. So there's a process involved here, and this would involve reworking parts of the process that are within the United Nations, because something right now is keeping India out of the United Nations, but there's some want and desire to have India in the United Nations, which means that policies have to be changed and action has to be taken on behalf of the Council in order to make this happen.
Well, let's see if we can clarify that just a bit, because India is, in fact, in the United Nations. They're an active member of the United Nations.
But not permanent.
Well, not permanently on the Security Council, and that's what we've got to get to here in just a moment. But the trick here is that the Security Council is the part of the United Nations that oversees the United Nations peacekeeping force.
Okay.
So the United Nations does have a very small military force that they are able to deploy in various parts of the world. It was one of the pieces of the United Nations that was made as a corrective to the League of Nations. The first version of this kind of international collaborative effort, well, it just didn't really have any teeth in it. It didn't have any ability to move troops. And so when the United Nations was formed, part of the commitment that each nation makes to the United Nations is contributing troops to the United Nations peacekeeping forces.
Originally, weren't these mostly American troops? Is something that I remember from...
An awful lot of them.
Yeah.
The United States has this odd relationship with the United Nations where, on the one hand, the United States is fiercely protective of its sovereignty as a nation.
Right.
On the other hand, we are the host of the United Nations. It's based in New York City. And for many years, we have been the chief source of financial funding for the United Nations.
We really take care of this organization, for sure.
So what where the Security Council then comes in is that the Security Council has the ability to intervene in existing armed conflicts between members of the United Nations through a Security Council resolution that condemns a current act of violence and so on.
Okay.
So when we're asking the question of India being a permanent member then, really we've got to go back to the UN Charter. As we'll link in the show notes, particular articles of the UN Charter explain that only 5 members of the Council have permanent status, but there are 10 that have temporary status.
On the Security Council.
On the Security Council.
I feel like there could be a lot of conflict with having temporary members, and then you want to say one thing, but then you're out of the, because of your temporary membership from the United Nations Security Council, and then you're back in, and then you're back out. What is this? Why is there temporary membership on the Security Council, do you think?
Well, because this is part of the heart of this debate. When the United Nations was formed, right in the aftermath of World War II, England, France, and the United States had just won World War II and the Allies, and in cooperation for a very brief time with Russia and China, they carved out a particular definition of what's often called the New World Order, a certain geopolitical position and looking at how can we collaborate internationally, how can we work together for better economic progress and trade. Well, and as part of that, the architects of this New World Order protected their ability to oversee that New World Order.
Right. Okay. So far we have United Nations and Grant. Can you walk us through India and sort of point us towards the magnitude of India and why it's being considered over any other nation in this debate? Why should India be admitted to the Security Council?
Well, that probably begins with the very basic geography. If we are to go to India and recognize that India is often, it's considered to be a subcontinent, and it sits right in between the Middle East and Asia. So it straddles two different sections of the world. So geographically, it's very significant. The military presence of India was one of the other considerations for the resolution this month. And really looking at India's ability to influence those sections of the world is crucial. But it's not just their geography, it's also their population. As of 2019, India has 1.3 billion people in it. That is 17% of the world's population.
No small number, for sure.
No, that is absolutely true. And because of that, the argument, I think, is pretty easy to see that India ought to have the kind of global influence that would reflect a country that actually represents almost one-fifth of the world's population.
So what kind of economy does India have? Because you're talking about this massive global influence, and the other possible resolution for the public forum debate in April is centered around India's military. Mm-hmm. Walk us through a little bit of India's economy. Why is this such a significant global, like a global player, if you will?
Well, part of that is because over the last 50 years, India has catapulted itself into the modern world in terms of economic development, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of all kinds of new businesses, so much so that the Indian Brand Equity Foundation put it this way: India has emerged as the fastest growing major economy in the world and is expected to be one of the top three economic powers of the world over the next 10 to 15 years, backed by its strong democracy and partnerships.
Do you think it would do the United States well to have another democratic partner in the Security Council with them?
Oh, it's certainly, that would certainly be a great balance against communist China,
right,
and against technically no longer communist, but certainly no friend to the United States, Russia, under President Vladimir Putin. So
right.
India has much more closely aligned values and goals to the United States.
I can see that as a possible argument to have a secondary democratic power that's within the United Nations Security Council to help balance things out and keep that geopolitical order that everyone's looking for as the goal of the United Nations states.
Well, that certainly is a good argument on the affirmative side. Of course, the neg has the immediate counter. Why India and not 15 other countries?
Right.
Why India and not Brazil and not Portugal and not Thailand. Why not Australia? It seems like that's, we'll get into it in a few minutes, that seems like it could open a slippery slope that would destroy the nature of the permanent seats on the Security Council.
Right.
Now, one other thing I should mention is that there's part of India's economic activity is that they have an awful lot of brand new businesses that are starting up. So not only do we have lots of current economic activity, but we've got all the indicators that India's economy is booming and shows no sign of slowing down.
So can you relate this booming economy to a membership on a Security Council? Because I'm sure the economy and the military are extremely closely related, especially as far as funding goes. Why does India's economy weigh in for its membership on a Security Council?
Well, because certainly if we're thinking about how does the United Nations develop this world order and kind of hold the world together and moving towards common economic prosperity through trade, the amount of economic activity and the size of that economy should certainly come into play when we're considering who really deserves leadership.
Right.
So one of the big questions here, we've got the United States has a very large economy. Russia and China are both huge. But if we're considering current role on a global stage, France and England no longer make nearly as much sense to have their seats on the Security Council as they did in 1948.
I would agree.
So that's part of it. And Ethan, help us with some of the specifics of what does it mean? Let's get to our next word in the resolution. We're now on to permanence. Well, what's the distinction there between permanence and a temporary membership?
Right. Okay. So a permanent membership is opposed to the temporary membership, which means that it is forever. The temporary membership only lasts for 2 years, as far as the Security Council is concerned. And this would be a really big move on part of the affirmative team, because this means that it changes the composition of the Security Council to reflect actual global influence rather than historic influence. So this is saying, this is almost legitimizing India as a power on the Security Council now by making it permanent. And this is not based in history, but this is saying, okay, now India is able to help offer modern solutions to modern problems.
Yeah, that's a really significant point. And the only thing I probably want to add there is the reality that the permanent members of the council each of them have a veto vote. So part of during the Cold War, when you had a massive struggle between capitalist powers fronted by the United States and communist powers fronted by the Soviet Union, both of those powers were able to veto the other's moves in the Security Council because both Russia and the United States had permanent seats on the Security Council, which really locked the United Nations out from a series of global conflicts.
Right, and I think that's probably the most significant part of this resolution is that veto power, because if there's conflicting interests, which there are within the United Nations, then how is anything going to get done if everything is going to get vetoed? Because there's a winner and there's a loser on different sides of different policies. So how can India measure up to that, and will we gain a net benefit as a United Nations as far as it plays a part in the world?
Yeah, those are great questions. And all of it points us back to the difficulty of what the affirmative team's burden has on this case. Because the pro side is arguing for really rewriting the nature of the Security Council and opening that Security Council up. Well, so we've already talked mostly about the Security Council and what they do. But I think there's two other things that are probably worth noting. The first is that the Security Council is the only part of the United Nations that all the other member nations, even the ones that are not on the Security Council at all the other member nations are required to accept and affirm.
Right.
So if a resolution passes the Security Council, it actually does something for other nations.
And there's also a possibility for economic sanctions here, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right.
So that's three main powers that we've discussed that permanent membership would entail for India being on the Security Council.
Now, that is absolutely true. And so that really kind of finishes actually working through the resolution. We probably ought to talk a little bit more about some of the context around India and its history and how that creates some background that really is going to be at the heart of this debate.
This is where we're looking at your expertise as a debate coach. I know you're a history teacher and having a good, solid foundation in a lot of these things, because this is certainly not my area of expertise, but I will jump in where I can.
All right, that sounds great. I probably should preface this with saying that it's been about 11 years since then, but I went to India back in several years ago and got to spend 1 week in the city of Mumbai. And I thoroughly loved my time there in India. I was kind of amazed at how different it is from the United States, but it is a fascinating, dynamic country filled with lots and lots of beauty. Lots of heartache as well, but it's an amazing country. Well, let's start this with the year 1947. Ethan, are you familiar with the word partition?
No.
Well, partition is huge for India's history. Prior to 1947, India had been ruled by England for a variety of causes that don't really matter now. England had ended up in charge of ruling over India as a colonial power, part of the British Empire. By 1947, in the aftermath of World War II, England decided to basically give India to itself. But in a typical, classic British colonial move, they decided that as their parting gift, they were going to solve a difficulty in India.
What was that difficulty?
Well, that difficulty was something I think we can all resonate with. It's the fact that, honestly, if we get right down to the heart of it, people of different religions don't always get along.
How did they go about solving this?
Well, you know, it's easy, really. In a way, you just take your big map out and you take a big red marker and you draw a line and you say, this kind of people is going to live north of the line, and that kind of people, they're going to live south of the line.
What a great idea.
Well, it worked out about as well as you can envision.
Yeah, it does not sound like it worked out.
The line in this case is the northern border of contemporary India, and that was then renamed Pakistan. And the argument was that all Muslims would move to this area, which had a lot of Muslims in it already. But many Muslims were in southern India, and they were then forced to move north. Now, India was going to be the Hindu area. So we have a mass religious migration in both directions. Hindus in the north move south, Muslims in the south move north. Across 1947, there are tons and tons of incidences of extreme religious violence as these two groups cross each other, and as property is seized and stolen, and it created the basis of the ongoing India versus Pakistan tensions that have flared up just this week with a downed plane in Pakistan with an Indian pilot, and Pakistan doesn't want to return the pilot. India demands the pilot back. 2 weeks ago, we had a revival of the conflict in the Kashmir Valley because both Pakistan and India claim the Kashmir Valley. Now, the question, and so this is then going to be a problem going forward with India as this, on the UN, because part of the symbolic nature of the United Nations is that these countries are supposed to be about seeking world peace.
But they're not.
They're not, and that and this is not a problem that's unique to India. None of the other countries on the UN Security Council necessarily abstain from warfare, but if we're considering the question of should India be on this symbolic in this symbolic position on the Security Council, we've got to deal with the fact that occasionally it looks like India and Pakistan are both going to try to wipe each other out.
And what would happen to Pakistan if India got on this council? Because now India suddenly has a lot of power and a lot of other countries that could possibly back it.
Well, and we also need to consider the fact that both of these countries do have nuclear weapons.
Oh,
so
dear.
That adds a whole other wrinkle to the problem.
Well, would this help? Would India joining the Security Council possibly deflect India from using these weapons because other countries would want to veto this option because it could not possibly bring any interest in anybody else's favor?
Well, I mean I don't think it would necessarily. It might certainly be an avenue for the rest of the world to indicate displeasure with India's decision or Pakistan's decision or so and so on. But as long as India was not trying to use a UN peacekeeping mission to wipe out Pakistan, really, that wouldn't change what the Indian government did with its own army. Now, I hope our audience is clear. I'm not trying to state that India and Pakistan are both trying to commit genocide. I'm simply wanting to highlight this ongoing tension between the countries as something that debaters should be aware of as they're framing their arguments.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about India as a post-colonial power. I know that you've written this on our outline for today's episode. What does post-colonial power mean? Can you define that for us?
Sure. So this is getting at a kind of a tricky idea. There's been a lot of academic theory written about this idea, and we've linked some of those on this outline. We'll put on our Medium page at some point when I get caught up on show notes.
Right.
But the idea of post-colonial power is looking at parts of the world that used to be ruled by the European colonizers. Germany had a few small colonies in Africa. Spain had vast colonial holdings in Latin and South America. France had huge colonial holdings in mostly in Asia, but some also in Africa. England was, the line from Queen Victoria's age was that the sun never sets on the British Empire. The idea
right,
was you could
I've
just keep sailing east, or I'm sorry, keep sailing west, and you would always reach, you could literally follow the sun around the globe, and you would be always be in British territory.
Wow.
Well, across the 20th century, England gave away all of its colonial powers back to the people that they used to rule over. And that's a vast summarization for some of our listeners who know that history. I don't mean to disparage any of the pain or complexity in there. I just want to give a very brief summary. So the question becomes, what happens when the people that used to rule the world and rule huge sections of the world are now less dominant in their power in terms of current geopolitics, and the people that used to be colonized are now surpassing their former colonizers in terms of power?
Right, because now India has developed in a completely different direction than it would have if England were still ruling over it, because now India, one, has nuclear weapons, which is a major concern, I would say, in this resolution because of what could happen or couldn't happen based on India's new position or
right.
Kept status quo position. There's also the fact that it's a functioning democracy, and this could play a huge role as far as America having a partner in the United Nations Security Council with another democracy there and a quite powerful one,
mm-hmm.
as economically speaking at that. And they are a global leader in technology, innovation, and population as well.
And so all of a sudden, then that becomes a big question, which brings us to really the big concern of the debate, I think, is what does, if we assume that the United Nations Security Council actually reflects the five most powerful countries in the world, the question of the debate is, does India deserve to be there?
I think a really good question for any debaters out there analyzing this resolution to kind of think about is, what has India already done on the UN Security Council as a temporary member? Because this could really be an indicator as to India's intentions as a permanent member, and could, I think then we could draw some inferences based on abductive reasoning there, seeing what would happen in the future based on India's current atmosphere, if you will, within the Security Council.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion for further research. I don't know what that has been. I do know that the United States and India have been have worked together to create an Indo-Pacific military strategy where both nations are cooperating and collaborating. So I suspect we would see India moving in similar directions to where the United States has moved, but I don't know that specifically. That's a great idea. Now, the pro side, of course, should be arguing that yes, India does deserve to be on this council and does deserve that veto power that we've talked about, and that really, and that in addition to India deserving it, we have an added bonus that now we can recognize this former colonial power and welcome India to a ruling seat in terms of the current world order.
Yeah, I feel like on the pro side, it's really saying like it's about time, and this should have happened a while ago because India's been a post-colonial power for a while now, and as it's grown in influence, one, having it on the Security Council means that it will further grow in influence, and two, again, I think one of my biggest factors in debate is a second democracy that lies within the Security Council. But walk us through the con side a little bit. Why should India not be on the Security Council? What's the con team's stance on this?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think a lot of our listeners are going to hear what we've said already and assume that we're squarely on the pro side,
right,
which we shouldn't be if we're doing this correctly.
Nope.
So I think for con, Khan's argument needs to go in two different directions. Probably first, of course, India is a rising power, but they're not yet a global player on the world stage in the same way that Russia, the U.S., China, France, and England are. And really, one place that the Khan could go to look at that is a pretty funny story you and I were talking about before this episode, where that really it showed that while India has moved in a lot of directions, they're not quite at the level of proficiency that other nations are.
Walk us through a little bit of that story that we were talking about earlier with the submarine.
Yeah, so this story, we'll put the link up, but this story is reported on popularmechanics.com that a couple years ago, India purchased a decommissioned nuclear submarine from Russia, and they refitted it, and they were ready to launch this, and the submarine dove with one fatal problem.
The hatch was open.
The hatch was open. The hatch on the back left quadrant of this submarine was open, and they went underwater, and seawater flooded the internal propulsion mechanisms of the submarine.
I was actually talking about this story, I think last year, with an economics professor that also is a writer for the FEE, and he told me that India actually rented this submarine from Russia, so it wasn't even an actual purchase, but they had to give this thing back as well.
So really, I think Khan could take just at least that's now that's one story. That's not a ton of research. I don't know that we can conclude anything definitively from that one story.
No, I just think it's kind of funny.
It is pretty funny. I mean,
yeah.
Oh my goodness! I would. Oh, could you imagine being that poor guy?
Oh no! I wonder what's happening to him right now.
Oh, so really, I think Khan could make a. But Khan could be on the lookout for other places where India really demonstrates a. The fact that simply they are not yet at the point on their internal democracy where they are, and their external democracy, where they could handle this kind of position in the global community.
I think one thing Khan is really going to have to play on is not looking at the economy as a defining factor for should India be on the Security Council or should it not, because the economy is like, when I look at countries like France, I know France has an economy, but then you place that country right next to India and look at India's economy, look at India's population. It's just big, and it's certainly bigger than France's. And I feel like the Khan is going to have to focus on something else besides the economy in order to get their way with this argument. I think that key point is going to be past Democratic decisions outside of the Security Council and current Democratic decisions within the Security Council?
Well, I'll see. One other avenue that Khan could certainly go into is to argue really that the making this change would be a substantive reworking of the UN Charter. And so that opening up India and welcoming India to a permanent seat, now we all of a sudden need a whole new set of criteria for who gets those permanent seats.
Right, and that this reworking would be a bad thing. And I think one thing that Khan could point out here is if we work it to have the certain criteria, these criteria, to in order to admit India, that means that country X, Y, and Z would also have met the criteria in order to be a part of the Security Council, and this could be problematic for these reasons.
Well, it certainly would, and you'd also have to be able to explain, you have to tie the existing countries in there being willing to give up some of their power. Because I don't know why France or the UK would be willing to open the door to another country and share their power, or why they'd be willing to agree to a system whereby maybe 10 years from now they no longer qualify for their position on the Security Council.
Yeah. I could see that too.
So, and Khan has good avenues by which to argue. And one last one on the Khan side, or really two others on the Khan side that might then could focus on. I lost my train of thought. Khan could focus on India having internal climate change problems.
What?
Yeah, it's kind of a stretch.
I'm out.
You're out.
Have fun with that one.
Yep, you're not in. Well, here at least is the argument. I'm not sure I hold to this at all, but I think there is an argument to be had there. And certainly we've gone to enough tournaments where people run to climate change for their arguments.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So here's how I think Khan would need to set this up in order to run this argument. You need to establish the United Nations as being all about climate change, and then look at India as one of the most polluting global economies on the planet, which they are. We found that evidence when we were researching the carbon tax resolution.
Right.
One of our main arguments ended up being that the United States adopting a carbon tax is meaningless as long as India and China continue to pollute at such levels. So really then you could make the argument that India does not fit with the United Nations position on climate change and therefore should not be in this seat.
You know what a great counterplan to that would be?
Please, give me. I don't even like making that argument, so if you've got a counter, I'd love to hear it.
I think a really effective counter to that argument would be to take AOC's quote about not having as many children, and we could just suggest to India that they would have less children or even stop having children, and then that would solve climate change because she'll get back to us on that.
Oh, my. Well, I don't see that argument going over very well at all.
No, but not whatsoever.
Now, but that does get to an interesting, that links us to the other idea I was trying to remember a moment ago and forgot. What if this is not in India's best interest at all?
Huh, that's interesting. Could you argue, like, on behalf of India here? Because you're looking at the United Nations and the benefits for the rest of the world. What kind of standpoint could a debater take on saying this is bad for India and valuing India's well-being?
Well, see, India is a fascinating country. It's a country of contrast in a lot of ways. India has this exploding democracy and this explodingly, in a positive sense, exploding economy. But the problem with India is that the development is in the core cities, but the development is not spread evenly throughout the Indian countryside. So I think there's an easy argument to be made that while certainly the pro side is pushing for India to take a stance on the global stage, Khan could certainly make an argument saying, no, India needs to focus on making India the best country for Indians that it can, and simply not worry about what benefits India can bring to the rest of the world through the United Nations.
Just simply because it's not ready. It's growing so fast, but it doesn't have the established foundation that it needs to be a part of the council, is what you're saying?
Well, not even necessarily so much that being part of the Security Council could simply be a distraction from further developing the resources that India has in and of itself.
And I think the affirmative or the pro team would have a really hard time coming back with benefits to India joining for itself, because I think the main focus of the pro in this debate would be benefits to the entire world. But then again, even though it's a public forum debate, there could be an underlying values clash there of benefiting the world versus benefiting one country. And I feel like if someone were attentive to that, that could be a major rebuttal topic for that entire round.
It certainly could be. So really, to kind of sum this up, I think we've presented hopefully reasonable possibilities on both sides, where kind of pro has access to a sort of a post-colonial theory kind of idea that India was once ruled over by England but has now risen to a position of unique possibility and authority. But con has a great argument to make in terms of India should focus on India and simply not worry about this if this kind of move actually harms their country rather than benefits it.
Yeah, I see where you're going. And I think, yeah, I think that we've pretty much covered the main avenues, because I know that in this debate especially, there are some crazy arguments that people could come up with. And I think climate change was just scratching the surface of that. But I think through whatever research we've provided and whatever advice we provided, those are the main avenues that debaters would likely take in this resolution, likely should take, I would say, because as we talked about in the definitions episode, stretching things to the farthest reach of the imagination is not something that should be done, at least in my opinion.
Right, and certainly not with a resolution like this, where there honestly is a lot to be had here. There's some resources that we've got linked here that I'll at least just mention. So one document that both sides should look at is the UN Charter, particularly Articles 23 through 32, which are detailing the essential nature and the task of the UN Security Council. If any of our listeners are intrigued about this post-colonial theory idea, in our show notes, we've got a five-page summary or introduction to the theory linked, as well as two theorists whose resources are freely available on the internet. The introduction and chapter one to Edward Said's Orientalism, as well as the essay by Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak, Can the Subaltern Speak? Those would both all be resources for really building this kind of theoretical approach if you want to run a post-colonial theory on the pro side. Yeah. Again, not that you should, but it certainly is an argument that is accessible to the affirmative.
Right. Just debaters, just remember to stay within what's reasonable for the round. I think that's just a general debate principle, because not only is it not in the best interest of the round to go to the furthest reach of the imagination, but it's also in your best interest not to, because I've found throughout debate experience in external tournaments and even in Coolidge tournaments as well, that the further you reach and the further you stretch something, the less tangibly pragmatic it becomes when it comes to implementing policies, especially for a public forum resolution.
Well, thank you for that closing advice, Ethan. And with that, I think we have reached really the end of our time for this episode. Ethan, if any of our listeners want to get in touch with us, how can they do that?
Right. If you want to get in touch with What's the Res, you can follow us on Instagram at whatstheres_, or you can email us at whatstheres@gmail.com. That's whatstheres@gmail.com with any of your questions regarding this resolution or debate in general.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us today on What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. Join us next time for more What's the Res.